Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life. Additional support for The Pulse is provided by AstraZeneca and Independence Blue Cross.
Trying to flex your muscle once again.
This shot hurts, but that's not why people are reluctant to get it. I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
There is this myth that scientific progress is achieved by some sort of a direct march to the truth.
I think sometimes I meet scientists, and when they hear what I do, they're a little afraid.
They will eject their entire digestive tract, and then they will grow a brand new one.
Weird ideas are all over the place.
So the question is, why?
What are we always so against?
What do you get for having a bigger brain?
Well, you'll probably hear the sound of a lot of rushing water dripping.
Zero.
On today's show, medical boot camp for war zone reporters, a tribute to an invention that changed how we eat, and when cause meets cash, a look at the history and economics of health awareness campaigns. Speaking of which, did you know it's National Immunization Awareness Month? More on all that business later, but it does provide the perfect segue to our first story. Vaccines make some parents uncomfortable who feel their kids are getting way too many shots. Now add to that three words that no parent of young kids wants to even think about: sexually transmitted disease. A vaccine given to preteens can protect them from the human papillomavirus, the most common sexually transmitted infection. HPV can cause cancer later in life, but vaccination rates remain stubbornly low. There are a few places around the country that are doing better than the rest of the nation at bucking that trend. One example is Chicago. Tanya English reports.
When I called Chicago's health commissioner and asked how the city boosted its numbers, she said go see pediatrician Cesar Menendez. His practice is on the south side, and the phones never stop ringing.
Good afternoon, doctor's office. How may I help you?
Tome asiento.
For 30 years, Menendez has been doing back-to-school checkups, well baby visits, and he makes sure that kids get their shots.
The doctor says the mindset for the office and everybody from that point on is involved in this. That's the only way that it's going to work.
When Menendez sees a patient who's around 11 or 12, there's a reminder right in the medical chart that the child is due for the first HPV shot.
And these are the typical sticky notes that they put in the chart. They annoy me, but they do a good job annoying me.
The office has electronic records and a system that could be set up to send digital alerts. But Menendez is old school, and colored sticky notes work just fine.
You don't need to be spending millions of dollars in a system that doesn't help you.
To be fully protected from HPV, kids need all three doses of the vaccine. And that means coming back to the doctor's office two more times within the next year.
Good morning, this is Francis calling you from Dr. Perez and Dr. Menendez's office.
We simply tell the parents that the child at age 10 needs a booster for diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus, the flu, and the HPV vaccine. End of the story. And if they have questions, we answer the questions.
That's the less is more approach. And Chicago Health Commissioner Julie Morita says it works.
We also didn't feel like we needed to have a whole separate conversation about HPV vaccine.
But more than 10 years after the vaccine was first introduced, some parents still have lots of questions. HPV is a vaccine with a good safety record. But early on, there were big political fights. Then, a few years ago, the government updated its advice. The vaccine isn't just for girls anymore. Boys are supposed to get it, too. Plus, there's the sex thing. HPV spreads through intimate contact.
It's such a common disease that most people will get HPV infections if they're sexually active.
People don't want to think about their 11-year-old having sex, even if that sex is way off in the future. So some families say no to the vaccine or put it off for a few years. Morita says that's a bad idea. The virus causes cancer in just a small percentage of people, but doctors have no idea which people.
We don't wait to vaccinate children until after they're exposed to diseases. If there were a vaccine to prevent cancer, wouldn't you want your child to get it? HPV vaccine is a cancer prevention vaccine.
Last year, Chicago won an $800,000 grant to test new vaccine strategies, and the city placed public service announcements on radio and TV. Now the city's three-dose coverage level for teen girls is 53%. That's up from about 37% the year before. Marita says it's a big win.
I have to admit, my 12-year-old didn't get his vaccines on time because it was hard to get him back into the office because he's playing basketball, baseball, he's got science club. We couldn't get him back in on time, and I forgot. And I'm highly motivated.
Chicago keeps track of HPV vaccine rates and issues a report card to doctors and nurse practitioners. The health department also sends Rachel Kasky out to talk with providers about how they're doing compared to colleagues around the city. Kasky says lots of well-intentioned doctors over-explain the benefits of the vaccine because they're trying to overcome distrust and confusion.
We have to tell you about this. We want you to know all about this. This is important. By doing that for just one vaccine sends a message that it's different.
Parents notice when they're doctors anxious, so Kasky encourages pediatricians to relax a bit. She wants providers to recommend the HPV vaccine the same way and on the same day that they recommend all the other adolescent vaccines. But in the end, she's pragmatic.
And I say, look, this is a three-dose series. The sooner you get all three, the quicker you are protected. However, two's better than one, three's better than two. If it takes us 3 years to get them done, it takes us 3 years to get them done.
The government says kids should be vaccinated at age 11 or 12. But the reality is, lots of children don't get the vaccine until high school. High school senior Isaac Moore is pretty sure he's protected.
Do you know what HPV is?
Ooh, yeah, the disease, the human papillomavirus.
Christina Arredondo thinks she got the shots.
Because I remember those letters. I remember the abbreviation, but I don't know what it is. Yeah, they probably told us at the time what it was for, but I don't know now.
Isaac and Christina attend Proviso East High School in Maywood, Illinois, just west of Chicago. There's a separate health center on the school grounds where families register and kids can get their primary health care. Nurse practitioner Colleen Andrioni says her patients are right down the hall, but there's another way to reach them.
Texting is really the way to go with students, okay? Texting, it's all about texting. Don't even bother making a phone call.
Andrioni says she wishes there were more community conversations about HPV to help her explain to parents and kids the connection between the virus and cancer.
So that they're aware of that before they come in and see me.
Doors closing. Pulaski is next.
Back on Chicago's South Side, pediatrician Cesar Menendez examines fifth grader Anthony Rivera.
Open a big mouth and say, ah. Say, ah. Good.
Are you a good student or a troublemaker?
I'm a good student.
Good for you. You have a girlfriend?
Yeah.
What is her name?
Jocelyn.
Is she pretty?
Anthony is the right age for the HPV vaccine and all the other preteen immunizations.
The booster for diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus. The flu every year, and the human papillomavirus is a series of three. Mm-hmm. He's getting the first one today, the second one is in 2 months, and the third one is in 6 months. This is the vaccine that is going to prevent him from getting genital warts and for girls to get cervical cancer.
Okay.
It's an important one, okay?
And that's it. No questions from mom, no complaints from Anthony.
Just relax your arm as much as you can, okay? Did you notice that it hurt?
Yeah.
Yeah. Stings a little. You're all done with this, okay?
And at the front desk, on the way out, another quick reminder.
So we see Anthony in 2 months, May 2nd, Saturday, 11:30 for his second HPV.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Tanya's story was produced with support from the Solutions Journalism Network. It's a nonprofit dedicated to reporting on responses to social problems. Stories for The Pulse typically takes our reporters into doctors' offices, hospitals, science labs. We spend some time in banana warehouses, swamps, and marshes, where our biggest enemy might be some pesky mosquitoes. But many reporters venture into infinitely more dangerous territories. They are capturing images and stories in war-torn regions. Whoa! Journalists, many are freelancers, have covered the conflicts in Ukraine. They have been in Iraq. And, of course, they are documenting the Syrian civil war, just to name a few. And often those reporters and cameramen are working without a safety net. Even though they are on the front lines, they have little or no training in emergency first aid. That makes them especially vulnerable to a sniper's bullet or a piece of shrapnel. A program designed to remedy this knowledge gap is underway a bit closer to home. Carrie Barber reports.
It's a Thursday afternoon in the Bronx, and the hot summer sun beats down on a small courtyard behind a brick building. Two bodies lay face down, covered in blood. A few yards away are two more bodies, not moving. Smoke billows around them, and the air is full of the chaotic sounds of helicopter blades, gunfire, and crying babies. Two young men run to the bodies and crouch beside them. One wears a navy vest of body armor that reads "Press" in large white capital letters. It's the fourth day of training for RISC, or Reporters Instructed in Saving Colleagues, a program that trains journalists in simple life-saving procedures for use in war zones. The bodies are teaching dummies, and the blood, well, that was mixed up in milk jugs by the instructors a few hours earlier. But the stress infusing the courtyard? That's 100% real.
What happens when there's any type of stressful event is that your brain kind of looks for a script to follow or a memory of what to do. And if you don't have any memories, it falls on horrible things like TV shows we've watched or stupid friends that we've had or, you know, our great-grandmother who used to do something that is no longer, you know, appropriate. And so what happens here is that these people get exposed to a certain, you know, degree of training, what they should do in those moments, and their brain will come back to it.
That's Instructor Sawyer Albury. She recently retired from a long military career that included working as a flight medic in Iraq and at an aid station in Afghanistan. She knows exactly what journalists will be up against on the battlefield and works with RISC to help prepare them.
I frequently get emails back from my students who say, you know, when something bad happened, I was doing it and I could hear your voice in my head. Like they have their brain has a place to go to. And if it doesn't, then they're just going to panic. And I think that's an important thing.
RISC was developed by Sebastian Younger, author of The Perfect Storm, and a longtime war correspondent himself.
I started RISC after my colleague Tim Hetherington was killed in combat in Libya. He bled out from a wound that wasn't necessarily mortal, but none of the freelance journalists around him knew what to do to try to save his life. So I decided after his death to get out of war reporting and to try to start an organization that would train freelance, experienced war reporters in life-saving techniques on the battlefield.
As Younger said, the course is for freelancers who don't have a TV network or a big newspaper behind them providing training before they go or health coverage when they return.
Many people don't understand that most of the real frontline war reporting is done by freelancers. You know, when you watch the news in the evening, some of it's coming from, you know, regular paid correspondents for the network news or cable news, but even their material is often taken from freelance sources who really go unnamed and unacknowledged.
The course is 4 days long. Funded by donations, it's free for trainees, including their lodging. 230 journalists, mostly photographers, have taken the course in the U.S. and abroad since its inception in 2012. Three of its alumni have already died in action. The teaching focuses on injuries that lead to preventable deaths. Sawyer Albury again.
You know, the research shows us that there's four preventable deaths on the battlefield. The four preventable deaths are bleeding, airway management, tension pneumothorax.
Those are chest and lung injuries.
And hypothermia. So we touch all of those subject matters here. And what we really need to make sure that they understand, these journalists, is that they have to stop the bleeding. And if they can do that, then they can actually, you know, save a life and pull someone from the jaws of death.
The students devote a fair amount of time to learning to stop bleeding.
There's your squirter. There's your leaker. So see if you can't just reach your hand all the way in there and pinch off that vessel.
Yes.
Start at one end and just start feeding it in like a giant snake.
That's Instructor Faye Johnson talking about packing a cloth bandage around a bleeding blood vessel.
Push it in really, really pack it tight. Fill every void.
Not a girl, let's see.
They're working on a supermarket chicken. It provides good practice for stopping bleeding. and other drills throughout the course teach trainees to perform additional first aid skillfully and quickly. They may need to do it for real one day halfway around the world, or they may be a little closer to home. Charlie Mostaller attended the training. He's a Philadelphia-based photographer.
A lot of the stuff we're learning here is applicable in protest situations and then in those horrible kind of spur-of-the-moment inner-city violence, you know? And so I think a lot of the people in this class will be, even if they don't go off to a conflict zone, will be much more able to provide help when things hit the fan.
And that's the whole idea. Instructor Sawyer Albury again.
To me, it's really important to make sure that all of these freelance journalists get the chance to save themselves. I mean, no one should go into a war zone without the ability to save themselves or the people around them.
Thanks to her and her colleagues at RISC, another crop of journalists will be a little bit safer now as they go out to bring the news of a sometimes violent world into the calm sanctuary of our living rooms.
All right, you can pause where you're at.
For The Pulse, I'm Carrie Barber.
Yeah? Why don't you guys come on up here? Let's talk.
Coming up, what color is your ribbon, your pin, your rubber bracelet? Illness awareness campaigns use smart marketing tactics to raise dollars. We'll take a look at how this all came about and who wins. Still to come on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to offer employees a vibrant, stimulating, and collaborative work environment. AstraZeneca aims to foster a culture that puts patients first, promotes scientific curiosity, values the power of diversity, and ultimately attracts, develops, and retains great people. Learn more about career opportunities with AstraZeneca at astrazeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. That's why they're proud to offer health programs, including fitness reimbursements and health coaches, to help keep you healthy. And it's why they're proud to sponsor programs and events around the city like the Blue Cross Broad Street Run and Indigo, Philadelphia's first bike share program. More at ibx.com and rideindigo.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Hey, did you know August is Children's Eye Health and Safety Month? Are you wearing your Nursing is Natural bracelet? Because it's also National Breastfeeding Month. And you should pin on your orange and purple ribbon. It's Psoriasis Awareness Month as well. By the way, August is a slow month for awareness campaigns. Some months have well over 20 health causes attached to them. We're going to talk about the economics of these campaigns in a little bit, why big business gets involved sometimes, and why some of the marketing tactics annoy survivors. But first, let's take a look at the campaign, the color that everybody knows, pink, for breast cancer awareness. But it didn't start out being pink. It all started with a peach ribbon. Audrey Quinn brings us the little-known story of breast cancer awareness.
Hello, this is Nancy.
Hi, Nancy. It's Audrey.
I called to Nancy Haley because I wanted to hear about her mother, the late Charlotte Haley, a housewife, community volunteer, and creator of the world's first breast cancer ribbon campaign.
She was a character. If you met her, she would probably make you laugh. She just had a wicked sense of humor.
Charlotte Haley lived in Simi Valley, California. It's an L.A. suburb. Her daughter Nancy actually still lives there, in her mom's old house. Charlotte was super family-oriented. So when her older sister and then her daughter Nancy got breast cancer in the 1980s, it hit her hard. And at that time, there wasn't much of a breast cancer movement. So Charlotte decided to start one in Simi Valley. She wanted better funding for breast cancer research. She wanted to promote self-exams and testing. So she created a simple awareness ribbon to fold and pin to a piece of cardstock. The ribbon was peach, her favorite color.
And there it is. That's one of the first cards.
This is Charlotte Haley from the 2011 documentary Pink Ribbons. She's reading from the card.
Breast cancer awareness ribbon. Join this grassroots movement. Help us to wake up our legislators and America by wearing this ribbon.
Charlotte started handing out the cards with the ribbons in her grocery store parking lot. She'd leave stacks of them at doctor's offices. Around the same time, a group of artists in New York had created a ribbon for AIDS, a red one. And by late 1992, the Red Ribbon had made an incredible amount of progress for AIDS awareness. Charlotte figured her peach ribbons could do the same for breast cancer, so she decided to take her ribbons global. She also sent them to First Ladies and Dear Abby.
It was just the idea that some people can wear something. If they see it, they'll ask you the question, why are you wearing a peach ribbon? And people would tell them.
How many do you think she sent out all in all?
40,000.
40,000?
Yeah. Well, 5 per envelope. And her grandson, Carl, he would fold the ribbons, and she would glue them and pin them on.
Carl's dad, Charlotte's son, would drop him off at Grandma's after school. He thought folding ribbons was fun. Nancy helped, too. She'd go to Joanne Fabrics and buy up all the peach ribbon reels. Charlotte's husband worked extra hours to help pay for the materials and photocopying. She wouldn't take any money for her efforts. She'd return checks voided, tell people to give their dollars to cancer research instead. Charlotte's ribbons started getting mentions in the local paper, then the LA Times. And then came the phone call that changed everything.
They called, and my dad was on the other phone, and they wanted to help promote breast cancer awareness with the peach ribbon.
They being Self Magazine, specifically the editor at the time, Alexandra Penny.
My mother and dad were looking at each other, and they said, well, what are you going to do with it? And they said, companies are going to do it, and percentage is going to go to breast cancer. And she said, no, you're going to commercialize it. That's making money off of somebody else's pain and suffering. And I've been through that with my sister and my daughter, and we just can't do that.
I talked to Alexandra Penny, the Self Magazine editor who called. She didn't want to be interviewed on tape for the story. But she said she'd figured she and Charlotte Haley were in the same boat. She'd seen people she loved suffer from breast cancer. She was upset how low the funding was for research. And she wanted better visibility for breast cancer awareness. But she wanted to pair with businesses to do that. Penny was confused why Charlotte Haley would refuse her partnership. But she had had her heart set on a ribbon campaign, with or without Charlotte's cooperation.
They said, well, all we have to do if we want it is to change the ribbon.
That's Charlotte Haley again from the Pink Ribbons documentary. Penny's lawyers told her she just needed a new color. She chose pink and teamed up with Estee Lauder, the makeup company. The October 1992 issue of Self Magazine launched the Pink Ribbon Breast Cancer Campaign. And Estee Lauder handed out pink ribbons at its makeup counters across the country. And basically, that was it for Charlotte Haley's peach ribbons. The pink ribbon became the breast cancer ribbon we all know today. And Alexandra Penny's remembered as the ribbon's creator. But her ribbon wasn't the first pink ribbon either. The Susan G. Komen Foundation, the people who do the big breast cancer fundraiser Race for the Cure, they'd already handed out pink ribbons at their first New York City race in 1991. Pink happened to be the foundation's color.
Alexandra Penny, I'm fairly certain, was at or around the first race.
That's Vern Calhoun. He's director of communications at Komen Greater NYC.
So I'm guessing that she saw it at the race and that it stuck with her come 1992 when she was looking for a way to blow out Breast Cancer Awareness Month for the magazine.
Original or not, Penny's pink ribbon and the commercial campaigns that followed did change the game for breast cancer. In the early 90s, it was a disease you only whispered about.
Nowadays, I don't think anybody thinks twice about talking about it, thank God. But back then, it was dirty.
Think about this for a second. It seems totally silly to us now that breast cancer had some kind of seedy connotation. These days, it's presented like some wave of pink goodness. The NFL goes all pink for October. But talking about breast cancer meant talking about boobs.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And a lot of women felt stigmatized when they got it.
And it's not just attitudes that have changed about breast cancer. There's now a whole host of new treatment options. Breast cancer research is now the best-funded cancer research in the country. So much awareness has been raised that some people say it's gone too far.
If you go to the internet, then yes, you'll find all kinds of stuff about pink fatigue. Generally speaking, from my point of view, anything that makes people think about breast cancer, is a good thing.
I went to a fundraiser for Greater Komen NYC. I was curious how relevant the breast cancer ribbon is today. It was everywhere. Survivor Cheryl Hartwell had a pink ribbon on.
I have one in just sterling silver, and I have one with a shoe on it. And
Terry Wicks was one of the few men in the room. He was there with his wife, Jamie Wicks, and wearing a pink ribbon.
I usually put them all on my hats.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, all the time.
When I was diagnosed, he started doing it. Every pin I can get a hold of, he has it.
What does the ribbon mean to you?
It means a lot of survivors. A lot of survivors. And my best friends survived.
He's beaming at Jamie in that moment. Charlotte Haley passed away last February at the age of 91. Her daughter Nancy says the pink ribbon and the wider breast cancer awareness that followed, the credit goes to Charlotte's grassroots campaign.
We talked about it about a month before she passed away. My sister and I was there, and we both looked at Mom and said, "Hey, you started that," and she just laughed. She says, "Yep, I did. Even though it's a different color, it's still your idea, Mom. And look what it's become."
There must have been a lot of pride in that.
Oh, God, yeah. We were so proud of her.
This August marks 26 years that Charlotte Haley's daughter Nancy has been clear of breast cancer. Charlotte's older sister Iris has been breast cancer-free for over 30 years. She's now 95 years old. And the five-year survival rate for early diagnosed breast cancer is now nearly 100%. For The Pulse, I'm Audrey Quinn.
What's the business, yeah?
This Pulse piece inspired an episode of the podcast 99% Invisible on AIDS awareness ribbons, and we'll link to it on our website. Audrey's report touched on the sometimes uncomfortable marriage between a good cause and business. On the one hand, there's a everybody wins mentality, but some survivors get angry at the idea of corporations getting involved with illness awareness campaigns. This issue hit close to home for Philadelphia guitarist and singer Joey Dubek. He's one half of the punk band Pinkwash. Many of the band's songs are inspired by Dubek's experiences in caring for his mother during her 14 months battle with breast cancer. Pinkwashing refers to marketing tactics where the color of consumer goods is temporarily changed to pink, and companies pledge a percentage of sales to breast cancer research. Critics say that when companies like Estee Lauder, KFC, or BP go pink, it's to sell products and not to donate money. Dubek talked about incorporating this topic into his artistic work, and he told us he finds peace in cacophony.
In February of 2008, I had just quit my job at this animal rights nonprofit, saved up a bunch of money, didn't have any plans, and literally a month after that, my mom got sick with stage 4 metastatic breast cancer. My aunt and my grandmother came up from North Carolina to help get her settled. They were just kind of like, "Well, you know what you got to do now." So I was like, yep, I mean, yeah, I can do this. And I have to. The day-to-day was getting up, making breakfast for us, driving her to chemotherapy, getting home, making lunch, getting some dinner, watching TV. We watched a lot of Sex and the City together. Once a month, my aunt would drive up from North Carolina and stay the weekend or stay like 5 days so I could get out of the house and hang out with people. It was essentially that for 14 months. My mom passed away in March of 2009. Pinkwash is based out of the frustration of dealing with my mother dying from breast cancer. Long after acceptance comes extreme bitterness. I'm bitter about the fact that myself and my family, we just feel a little exploited by the cancer industrial complex.
For every pink bucket of grilled or original recipe, KFC makes a 50-cent contribution to Susan G. Komen for the cure.
I ski with pink. I can't get enough pink. Come on, everyone. Buy Raspberry 5-Hour Energy, benefiting living beyond breast cancer.
I'm just using that as my fuel to write these songs.
You, right. Dance.
wanted to play loud music because of how it would affect me emotionally. When I was 8 years old, my mom got me the Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy, and the Infinite Sadness double CD. That was my very first CD.
Despite all my rage, I am still just a rat in a cage.
Like, at that time, I would listen to some songs and be terrified by them because they would be so intense and so heavy.
Despite all my rage, I am still
Billy Corgan would be screaming in them. Not only do I like writing heavy rock songs, it's also something that can speak to people. I really just want the audience to feel something. In the same way that you might watch a sad film and feel cathartic about it. You'll process something in watching the film and then feel better.
Joey Dubek, who together with Ashley Arnwine forms the Philadelphia punk band duo Pinkwash. Dubek lost his mother to breast cancer in 2009. Jonathan Pfeffer produced this piece. So we've heard about the history of awareness campaigns and also just listened to this very critical perspective on businesses getting involved. Joining us now to talk more about who wins and why companies want to do this in the first place is Deborah Small. She is a professor of marketing and psychology at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
What's in it for companies? Why do they want to get involved with campaigns around diseases?
Well, these brands care about their image, and consumers like brands that are perceived to be competent but also good. And so it's particularly attractive to a company if they can link up with a cause that their consumer base cares about. And that's why we see so many campaigns, cause marketing campaigns with breast cancer, because the biggest consumers of packaged goods in particular are women. And this is an issue that is near and dear to most women's hearts.
And how about the other side? Why would organizations that, you know, do breast cancer research, why do they want to team up with corporations?
So I think of this as actually three sides. So there's the company, which we discussed already. There's the cause, and there's also the consumer. So let me speak to both of those. So organizations want to be involved in these campaigns because they gain awareness by their association to brands that have lots of exposure, so particularly big brands. In addition to that, this oftentimes supports their fundraising efforts. So when a portion of proceeds is donated to the cause, multiply that times all of the consumers out there, that's significant revenue. Moreover, we think it often tends to be revenue from customers who wouldn't otherwise donate to those causes, but they're still going to buy their breakfast cereal and their cosmetics and so forth. And if they care just a little bit, then they might be motivated to purchase the one that has the pink ribbon in which, you know, 10% or however much is donated to the cause. And so it attracts, like, it's kind of a different segment for the organizations that they wouldn't otherwise engage through their regular fundraising tactics.
And what about consumers? How do they benefit from this, or do they?
Consumers definitely benefit. They benefit by getting to feel good while they're purchasing things for themselves. And that's fascinating to me. So they get this boost of do-good pleasure. Plus, they get to signal to themselves and oftentimes to other people by the display of the products that they buy. So think about a person wearing a pair of sneakers that has the pink ribbon on it, or a t-shirt, or carrying a coffee mug at work that has the logo of a cause on it. Well, that signals not only to the purchaser, but also to everybody they interact with, that they're a good person that cares about a cause. And so that has real social value to consumers.
So what are the drawbacks? Are there drawbacks?
I think the drawbacks come in a few ways. When customers become suspicious that the company has ulterior motives, then they can react against this.
How are these matches made? How do companies pick an illness, a cause to get involved with?
So I think the key criteria is that it has to be something that their customer base cares about. I think that organizations are looking for brands that will bring them a lot of exposure.
Do they have to take into consideration, you know, is this a healthy brand? Is this a healthy product?
that is really, it's becoming increasingly clear that that's important, that, that there has to be some congruence between the product, the brand, and the cause. Otherwise, consumers just react really negatively to it. They see it as hypocritical, as inconsistent. They don't know what to make of it when, for instance, a food brand that's perceived as not healthy is supporting some health-related cause. That just doesn't feel right to consumers, and that raises all sorts of suspicion and has really negative effects.
I guess there are consumers who like to buy a product that's associated with a cause because they're doing something fun for themselves while doing a nice thing. And then there are those who say, well, just send a check. If you want to do something good, don't buy yourself a pair of sneakers. Just send a check to your cause. Is that just two camps, or do some people do both, or how do people feel about this?
There are different views on this. So it's true that more good could be done in the world if people just wrote checks. However, a lot of people aren't just going to write checks. And so this is one way to engage that segment of consumers who wouldn't just write checks. Maybe next year, once they're already a little bit engaged, maybe next year they'll actually write a big check.
Deborah, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Deborah Small is a professor of marketing and psychology at Wharton at the University of Pennsylvania. Coming up, imagine most of the food you consume on a daily basis being unavailable. And now look at your fridge with loving eyes. We'll talk about the history of refrigeration coming up on The Pulse.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca strives to create a culture where employees are excited by their work, have a clear sense of purpose, and display confidence in their ability to meet challenges and seize opportunities. More at AstraZeneca.com/careers.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and strives to lead the way with a focus on preventing illness rather than reacting to it. They are proud to offer health programs including fitness reimbursements and health coaches. IBX.com. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.
This is The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. I'm Mike and Scott. Maybe we should have a refrigeration appreciation month because we so often take this appliance and the whole concept of artificial cooling for granted. In his book, Chilled, How Refrigeration Changed the World and Might Do So Again, science writer Tom Jackson describes what our diets would look like without the power of cool. I spoke to him recently and asked him to read a passage from his book where he quotes another book, a 1956 cookbook called The Everlasting Pleasure.
When a housewife returns from the supermarket and whisks things into her refrigerator and closes the door, she has closed the door of the spring house, the milk and butter pantry, the root cellar, the cheese room, the smokehouse, and the cupboard well. At the same time, she has turned her back on the preserving kettle, the pickling crock, the pudding bag, the vinegar barrel. As for the ice house, the ice wagon, she has put them behind her too. Ice does not make the storage box cold. Instead, the box makes ice for all her needs.
That really sums it up, how much
we
have changed the way we shop and we eat. Name a few items that I would not consume in a typical day if it weren't for refrigeration.
Well, fish. You'd have to live very near to the sea if you fancied fish. Nowadays, the fish that's coming out of the nets is frozen almost instantaneously, and it won't be defrosted until it hits the grocery store. Well, you're sold. You're buying it fresh then. You're told it's fresh, but really it's just been defrosted.
And I guess anything else, what about milk, meat,
sure,
butter?
Yeah, milk can survive quite a long time. Butter, again, it would be a different experience, but you'd have it. It would be quite sloppy. And eggs, most of the year, you'd be all right. Just stay away from them in summer.
How was food kept cool before the arrival of refrigeration, or wasn't it?
It wasn't really, no. By the 17th century, people realized that keeping food cold actually stopped it from going rotten, but they didn't really have any means to keep things cold for very long. So they kept it fresh in other ways. Vegetables were buried in root cellars, which were generally colder than above ground. And other things were preserved in other ways. But the idea of fresh food before refrigeration was a major luxury.
We've talked a lot about food. What are some other things that rely heavily on refrigeration where we maybe not think about it as much?
Well, that's what really fascinated me about the subject in the first place, was that the ability to use heat to make things cold not only changed the way we consume food, but it also allows us to do a whole lot of other things. Air conditioning, obviously, which is basically a refrigerator, so it's split in half with the cool bit inside the house and the hot bit outside. That's changed the way we can populate the world. So there's the Sun Belt in North America and the Middle East, which would be an impossible place to live if it wasn't for air conditioning. Also the technology but just done much more efficiently and more effectively to much lower temperatures enables us to extract gases out of the atmosphere, things like liquid oxygen, which is inside rocket engines. That liquid oxygen is also used to make steel. Without being able to control substances using cold when we need to, our technologies would not be what they are today.
Tom, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Tom Jackson is a science writer. His latest book is Chilled: How Refrigeration Changed the World and Might Do So Again. You're listening to The Pulse. Honeybees are in trouble. They've been dying off in startling numbers over the past decade, many from something called colony collapse disorder. Researchers everywhere are looking for concrete causes and solutions, and now you can add to the mix an 18-year-old from Philadelphia who is creating a high-tech hive to track the health of his bees. The Pulse's Todd Bookman has this story.
There's something of an urban farm in Wingiri's backyard, lots of flowers and wildlife, and for the past few years, honeybees. Back in the far right corner of the property is a workbench covered with the mess that comes when you try to install the guts of a computer into a beehive.
It's about a foot and a half high. We've taken all of the frames out of it, which are the frames that the bees build off of. It's what you see that has all of the wax built up on it, all the like honeycomb shaped stuff. So we've taken all of that out, actually, and so now it's just an empty box with cables and wires and lights and cameras and stuff inside of it.
Once it's assembled, the box will stack onto one of Wynn's hives. If you've never seen one, man-made hives look like bedroom furniture, kind of like a chest of drawers with a little entrance on the front. All of the wires and sensors and cameras and microphones will hopefully shed some new light on what's going on inside the hive, and perhaps in the larger environment.
I went into the project being like, I want to solve colony collapse disorder, which is kind of funny coming from a kid my age, but the project's morphed a little bit, especially as I've talked to Max. It's kind of like, let's go in there, let's put these sensors in, and like, let's see if we learn something new.
Max is Max Lawrence, a 40-year-old artist who works with technology, and who at times comes off as less mature than teenage Wynn. And I mean that as sort of a compliment to both of them. They met at the Department of Making and Doing. It's a makerspace in West Philly. Wynn brought the bee knowledge, Max the tech know-how. Still, that combination hasn't made it easy to get this thing up and running.
I'm not really sure, man. It could be like 20 minutes. It could be 4 hours. It could potentially be next week. I mean, I'd like to say it's not, but like, I got limits.
There's a bit of a crunch here because Wynn leaves for college at the Rhode Island School of Design in a few weeks. He's hoping to monitor the bees from there, not just be able to watch a live stream over the internet, but actually track the smallest details of their lives.
In addition to the camera, we've got
alcohol sensors, methane sensors, humidity, temperature, noise level.
Plus carbon monoxide and dust sensors. All this gadgetry tucked into the corner of the hive. Wynn says it will beam out a pretty sophisticated stream of data.
For a little while there, I was saying that we were going to have the most advanced smart beehive in the world, which I still don't think is untrue, but at least at a hobbyist level, we will. I don't know what, you know, research universities and stuff are doing, but we're going to have a pretty intense setup here.
Turns out research universities are doing similar projects. In fact, everyone from the USDA to Greenpeace to Monsanto are paying attention. Honeybees play a huge role in our food system. They pollinate crops, including lots of nuts, berries, fruits, and vegetables. So struggling bee colonies put huge economic uncertainty onto the shoulders of farmers, both large and small. Backyard and rooftop enthusiasts are also under strain.
We've really struggled. And a lot of hobbyist beekeepers are really struggling. So last winter was our worst winter yet. We had one hive survive of the four that we had last summer.
There's a good chance some of his new hives will die off again this winter. There have been years when 60% of hives in Pennsylvania failed. And so for Wynn, the idea here is that if he's got all this data, perhaps he can zero in on what forces are at play. But unlike research universities and government agencies, he and Max are trying to build the smart hive on less than $500. And while they're knowledgeable, they're not exactly experts.
Because everybody makes it sound so simple. They're like, oh, yeah, just put it on the internet. And trying to get a data feed and video to stream real time out by a beehive through the firewalls of insert name of company there in the router settings, and then like everybody wants you to buy something so you have another plugin. It's just terrifying. Like the baby cam, I keep going back to looking at, being like, how do they make it work? You know, like, what is, should I just buy an iPhone and shove the iPhone in the beehive? Yeah, now looking back, probably shoulda. Like, wouldn't have known that if it weren't for the experience of doing it, you know.
While Max tinkers with an infrared lens, Wynn throws on a bee suit and pulls the veil down over his Buddy Holly glasses. He uses a stainless steel canister to shoot puffs of smoke at the bees. This calms them down as he cracks open the hive. The smoke technique, and really a lot of beekeeping techniques, haven't changed much over the years. Even the furniture-looking hive has been around since the 1850s. That's when a pastor from Philadelphia named L.L. Langstroth figured out this was the easiest way to harvest honey.
So Langstroth was born down on Front Street in Philadelphia, and he spent his life kind of designing the beehive. And so Philadelphia is known as the cradle of American beekeeping because the Langstroth beehive was actually invented over in Germantown. So it's kind of really cool to be working on such kind of an innovative project in the same city where modern-day beekeeping started.
Inside the hive, the female worker bees are going about their business, as they have for millions and millions of years, each carrying out a task to keep the hive up and running.
You have a lot of respect for what the bees are doing in here, and how organized everything is.
That organization makes it a good target for data collection. The bees tend to follow patterns, so it'll be easy, in theory at least, to see when those activities change. There's also another well-known aspect of life inside the hive that they want to study.
Another fantasy of Wynn and I is to be able to identify inside of the colony when the bee does a waggle dance. The waggle dance is when the bee shakes its butt and lets the other bees know where there's, syrupy goodness, like Mountain Dew, or like...
So the waggle dance is like a semicircular dance with a little zigzag through the middle, and so the direction that the bee's pointing tells the other bees which direction a good amount of flowers is, and the number of waggles is, or the number of zigzags, tells the bees how far. So this, like, magic communicational dance that these bees do let all of the other bees know where the flowers are, where the nectar is.
They want to use image recognition software, like Facebook uses, to digitally track the waggle dance, measure angles and movement, and create an interactive map detailing where the bees are foraging. It's the perfect marriage of nature and technology, at least in Max's head.
To be able to have that streams, those streams of data, to be able to manipulate and reintroduce to each other and recontextualize, it's a paintbrush. on some like Bob Ross, like happy bee accident. You know what I mean? Like throw it together, see what sticks. And if it doesn't stick, don't be so occupied with what you expect out of it, because that's bad science.
It's taken Max and Wynn 9 months to get where they are right now. But where they are right now is actually pretty good. The sensors are finally up and running and collecting data, which they're going to make public. And the infrared video feed is streaming a close-up look at life inside the smart hive. It is scary and awesome and transfixing to see. When Wynn leaves for school, his bees will be virtually there with him. And when some of them die this winter, as the odds suggest they will, he'll be watching too, and perhaps learning what's to blame. For The Pulse, I'm Todd Bookman.
And you can see photos of the smart hive at our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And of course, we have a link to the live stream beehive video from Wynn's website. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, Alana Gordon, and Todd Bookman. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Joel Patterson, our managing editor, Megan Pinto, the executive producer. Chris Satullo is vice president of news. Did you miss some of this show or any of our previous shows? Just subscribe to our podcast. It's on iTunes and also on our website, whyy.org/The Pulse. And that's also where you can get in touch with us, send us an email, ask us a question, suggest an idea for an upcoming story. We always love to hear from you. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.